I'm Sam Cedar. This week on Ring of Fire Radio, Justin Elliott from ProPublica will join us to discuss a piece he co-wrote detailing how an aerospace company made record profits by laying off employees while taking $1 billion from the U.S. government. Heather Digby-Parton will help me run down the news of the week. Listen, if you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor. Support the program. You can help us out by becoming a supporter over at ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby-Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we are getting closer and closer to the election. We are now, I guess, 5 weeks away as of Tuesday, or is it 6 weeks? I can't remember now. It really doesn't. I don't know if it really matters. I mean, because we are not going to hear the results of the election that night. We will get to the implications of that, of what we will hear. We, shortly after we recorded on last week, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. That obviously is a massive story in and has implications both in terms of the election, following the election, future elections. We really are at, I guess, you know, I want to say peak 2020, but in some ways that's too glib. I have been progressively getting more and more concerned. You know, I think you and I have talked about that over the past 3 or 4 weeks, and I am even more so today. I suspect tomorrow I'm going to be even more so. You know, I don't know where you want to start. Obviously, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, an icon, but I think most importantly, and I think in many respects, it's a shame. I think her legacy will not get the attention it deserves because of, frankly, an assessment she made about whether she should stay on in the court and just bad luck, right? I mean, we're 3 months out, 4 months out from when her passing would have not had implications for potentially millions and millions of people for years and years and years, frankly. And that is just, I guess, a quirk of history. But give me your sense of that, and then we can start to talk about the sort of the near-term implications.
Well, I mean, it's obviously it's a nightmare that this happened. I mean, for a number of reasons, the Justice Ginsburg having this happen in the middle of, I shouldn't even say in the middle, in the very final stretch of this highly contentious election where so much is riding on it, and it just kind of threw sand into the gears of what was already taking place. And and you're right, of course, it's tragic that it happened this way, both for her legacy, for the future of the country. I mean, it's a horrible tragedy. And it's one of the things about Donald Trump that I think that people underrate. I mean, I don't know whether or not you believe in, I think it's superstitious or whatever, but the guy is lucky. He manages to get out of trouble over and over and over again. You look at his life going all the way back, and he's always somehow just kind of managed to hang on and to get past it and to just, he can dance on the head of a pin for years on end. I mean, he's been, he was on the verge of losing everything in back in the early 2000s, and he came back out of it. I mean, it's just, if you believe in the concept of luck, this is one guy who it's a weird kind of luck because he's so bad at everything, but he somehow manages to survive. So, I don't underrate that. It's a weird kind. Maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't know. It's random.
I don't want to get too sidetracked, but I feel compelled here because I think it's instructive too. I mean, I think it's instructive relative to, the campaign that that Biden's running and why it may be a little more precarious in these circumstances than it would have been maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. He's Donald Trump is very without a doubt has a tremendous amount of luck. I mean, he was lucky the day he was born in terms of the family that he was born into.
Right.
But I do think that one thing that is clear is that he is relentless, and he is unwavering. Unfortunately, I think it's like, you know, sort of in terms of ignorance and a whole lot of other really distasteful characteristics. But he is unwavering. He is relentless. He maintains his compass heading in, a really horrible place, but it always stays in that direction. And I think on some level, that will that he has just to move forward and the total lack of shame, it puts him in a position to capitalize on those moments when he is lucky. A lot of people run into lucky opportunities and lucky situations. They are just not they're whatever it is. The unlucky part is that they're not necessarily ready to capitalize. He is ready to capitalize on these things, right? I mean, he made a conscious choice, and also, you know, in the context of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, to pack the court with right-wing ideologues. He knew enough to hold up that list of 20, potential justices in 2015. They were very directed on that. You know, I'm sure people told him, but he was, you know, at least sentient enough to realize, like, oh, these are the guys that I need to listen to. And he was lucky that Mitch McConnell had held up Merrick Garland, and that, you know, he found his ilk, people who were completely unrestrained by, you know, the institutions and didn't care for the institutions. I mean, so in that respect, it's not dumb luck. And I think that's important just to note. And I don't mean to like get, you know, sort of, I don't know, the tedious here, but I think it's important because I think there are some things that Biden's doing where he is, you know, staying on a specific trajectory relentlessly. But I also think it's a more passive one. And sometimes you can't ride things and take advantage of things when you have decided that the track you're going to follow is a passive one. In some respects, he's been able to maintain a very specific on message campaign. It's just that it is the strategy is to be passive, and it could swing either way. It's just sometimes like you can ride luck a little bit better when you are being, you know, super you're leaning into certain things. I just want to say that because I think that dynamic is important to note. I mean, it may be irrelevant, frankly, if Joe Biden doesn't win. But there are lessons to be learned, I think, from the Democrats on some level to, at the very least, some tactics and dispositions that Donald Trump has exhibited. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think now is the time to say, like, if the Democrats get in there, we need to really rebuild the institutions and reinstitute the filibuster, which, you know, Chris Coons was saying that less than 18 months ago. And so, you know, there's an attitude on the Democratic side that is far too, I don't know, concerned about or supposedly they're projecting a lot of things that are projections and aren't really necessarily the case.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I'm not particularly critical of Biden's campaign as he has been going along, simply because, you know, I think this is an election about Donald Trump, and I think Biden's almost a cipher. He's like a symbol of someone different, and I don't think it really matters much. And in a way, maybe because he is sort of prone to gaffes and other things, maybe keeping a lower profile makes sense.
But what I agree with that.
Saying,
go ahead. Yeah,
I think that where this becomes important is, and we're going to get into this in more detail here, is that, you know, once the election happens, and this is sort of, it's a process this time, it's not like a specific day that we're going to know and then everything, you know, happens. This will be something over the course of time, and as we've seen over the last, well, over the last few months, but it's gone into over warp speed since Ginsburg's passing, is this fact that they are planning to contest the election, you know, pretty much regardless. You know, they're looking at the polls, and it looks very, I mean, Trump could run the table as he did, you know, he could do it as he did in 2016 and just kind of squeak in. But this is a different kind of election because of the mail-in and because of everything that's happening with the pandemic. I think that they know that that's an unlikely outcome, that at midnight that night that we're going to know that he won, or, you know, that he won. That I don't think that's a really that's likely. There's going to be a lot of votes to be counted. So, you know, Biden can be passive all the way he wants, but if that's at the moment where, no, they cannot be passive.
Right.
They have to stop being passive, and I mean be aggressive and be prepared for an aggressive response to what Trump and his henchmen are planning. And this is pretty clear now. I think we can see, and, you know, I'm sure you've talked about on Majority Report and other places in the last few days, this article by Barton Gellman in The Atlantic, there's another one by Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker. People are writing about this as this is starting to become more obvious what their plan is. And it is specifically hinging, it appears, on the Supreme Court, this vacancy. Now, they didn't really need this vacancy. They had a majority. I mean, the idea that John Roberts now has suddenly turned into the second coming of, you know, Thurgood Marshall is a bit much for me. I mean, he made a couple of rulings that weren't too bad in an election year to try to keep things, you know, calm. But John Roberts is a conservative, and they had already had a 5-4 majority before Justice Ginsburg died. And I don't believe that you know, he was ever going to be someone that you could count on. He was not even Anthony Kennedy or any of the other swing justices. But now that this has happened, and they are making, they could clearly, Trump and his cronies are afraid that Roberts might, you know, decide to, you know, vote against them in some ruling in the Supreme Court, that they need to fill that seat before the election. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense otherwise, because normally what a normal politician would do would say, oh, I can use this to gin up my base and get people, you know, all the abortion people, they can come out. And I can say, look, if you don't vote for me, who knows what will happen in the lame duck. You need to vote for me, and then we'll have a mandate for this seat, and we'll do it. And the truth is they could pass, you know, they could fill the seat anyway in the lame duck if they really wanted to. But he's not doing that. He's saying, I want it in there. I want it done. Get it done. Get it done before the election. And he's saying expressly now, because he's an idiot, that he needs to fill that seat because he wants to make sure he's got the votes if the election goes to the Supreme Court. I mean, he's not even trying to hide it. So we are dealing with some really, you know, I mean, this, it's not entirely unprecedented, of course, because in 2000 they did that. And so they said, and the Democrats were very passive. You might recall they were very passive.
Very passive.
They were passive ever since then by not, when they had the chance, dealing with our problems with our democracy and our voting and our elections and all of that. They didn't really deal with it. So here we are again, and they have a little bit of a template for how to do this. They want to go to the Supreme Court, and they Trump wants his big majority.
Let me just add one addendum to that. And we've been talking about this for several weeks too. I mean, to my mind, it was quite clear that for months he has been basically trying to not necessarily get mail-in voting from not happening, but rather devalue it and say that it was irrelevant. It's not somehow not real votes. And look, Paul Ryan was talking about the shady California late results back in 2017. Yep. I mean, you know, let's be clear. This is a Republican Party project. And I will also say this, that I think there's some fail safes here. I think that 6-3 is a fail safe for Trump. I think they think that Roberts could be shaky in a certain circumstance, and so they want that. But I also think that it's quite possible that, and we mentioned this in the past, if there's a ruling in Wisconsin with a conservative state Supreme Court, or a ruling in Michigan with a conservative state Supreme Court, or a ruling in Florida with a conservative state a court, and, you know, where it's something like, we can't count the ballots, we need to stop counting, or there's something fishy about the mail-in ballots. What the 6-3 does on the Supreme Court is it makes it harder for there to be redress by anybody, and it makes it easier for the Supreme Court to say, we don't get involved in these type of things. Because, I mean,
well,
look,
that's true.
Everybody was very shocked that the Supreme Court got involved in Bush v. Gore. They could actually return to a more sensible perspective on this and not get the blame for what's going on. Just like, this is a state issue. This is a state voting. We don't get involved in this. And that could be, you know, because four justices could grant cert. Now, I don't know if it, you know, how that would work if Roberts said, you know, the four liberals or something like that. But I mean, I think it's just there's a fail safe mechanism here. If it comes from Pennsylvania, then maybe they'll take the case. Right. I mean, we don't know. And I got to also just throw this in here as a public service. Like, I refuse to talk about this stuff without telling people, expect on election day night, November 3rd, that at 11 p.m., Donald Trump will have something between 350 and 400 electoral votes if you were to project out where he's leading at that time, and Joe Biden will have 130. People should expect that. That should be the baseline, because the majority of Republican voters are going to be voting in person. The majority of Democratic voters, if the polls are right, are going to be voting by mail. The mail-in ballots, for the most part, not all of them, but for the most part, in most states, will be counted subsequent to that day. And, you know, in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin right now, there's like 4 or 5 days after the election, I think in six in Pennsylvania, where ballots can come in and be counted after the third. And those states are key states. So people should just be aware of this in addition to going out and voting. But continue, Digby. I didn't mean to sort of like go sideways. But I just want to make sure that whenever we're talking about this, we're saying those things so that people have the proper expectations and have the proper motivation to go out and vote in person if they can. If it's safe for you, go do it now.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad that you said, I mean, that's just a public service announcement that has to be made every single day, I think, if you have any kind of a platform going forward. And in fact, I was asking about this today, and there are a number of websites where you can go see what your state does. And there are states like, you know, like Arizona and Colorado, they start counting those votes as they come in or within a certain parameter before election day. Actually, Florida is one of those.
Yep.
It's 22 days prior they start counting. If you can get your vote in there, which even if you do it by mail, you can usually track. I think every state has some kind of a tracking mechanism. You can track your vote, make sure it got there, because we are having problems with the post office thanks to Donald Trump's, you know, putting sand in those gears as well. And there, if your state is one that starts counting them, you can go in and vote early, you know, when there aren't long lines. That's one way to do it. And the other way is if you have to, you know, if you're really concerned about your health, you know, obviously vote by mail, do absentee, do whatever. But, you know, make sure that you do it as quickly as you get it. Nobody should be waiting any longer than absolutely necessary to vote. Vote immediately. Get the vote in there, because that makes a difference. Now, as you point out, in some states like Michigan, they don't start counting until that day. And they've tried to change it, and their conservative Supreme Court won't let them do it. Minnesota's the same way. Wisconsin's the same way. So some of these battleground states are where the problem's going to be, and we can see that ahead of time. So that's where you're talking about, you know, these things not being contested. And hopefully we can persuade the press not to be so anxious to be reporting votes and doing all that stuff on election night. And I don't know if they'll do it. But in any case, this is what Donald Trump's plan is. And we know they're calling it the Red Mirage, which is the idea that on election night, he gets to claim that he was the winner and that any votes that come in afterwards, that are counted afterwards, whether they came in or it's just a counting delay. I mean, California takes months to count. You know, it's ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, so, you know, he'll just claim that they're all fraudulent, that everything that came in, I'm the winner on election day. He says this outright. And he even said the other night at one of his rallies, he says, we're counting on the federal courts to make sure that election night, he used the term election night, is the night we know the winner. So, you know, this is, he's you know.
McConnell said the same thing. McConnell. Yep.
Exactly. And, you know, and so, you know, we can see what they're doing. I mean, this isn't, they're not being particularly sneaky about it. They could be doing all this without talking about it, but Trump wants to set up this expectation that he's the winner. And by the way, he didn't come up with this idea. Your point about how this being the Republican way is really important. Trump is not, you know, Trump, of course, is blatantly and shamelessly trying to steal the election. But let's face facts. Republicans have been doing this for a long time. And one of the things that helped Bush in the 2000 election was that, you know, he was ahead in the count on election night. And that was where, you know, and then, of course, it, you know, triggered a recount and did all this stuff. But that being ahead meant that they were able to call Gore and Lieberman sore losermen, you remember, and how they would just would keep counting until they get the votes they want, and they had this whole narrative around it, which the media went along with eagerly. And that's it, you know, so they this precedent of 2000 is really coming back to bite us here. They're using a lot of that as a way. Now they're going even further with the idea of having this Supreme Court, and I think it's brilliant that you saw this thing with the Supreme Court failsafe, because I hadn't thought of that. If they have a 6-3 majority, it means that they have the capacity to refuse to intervene from some lower court, lower court or some state court case. If they don't want to do it, and that gives it more legitimacy, right? They can say, look, you know, we don't interview, this is political, we're not going to do it. So, you know, this is all very, very, you know, these people have really thought this thing through and are ready to go in whatever direction. Now, the Barton Gellman story that was in The Atlantic, and Tubin had this too in The New Yorker, was this idea now that they've got this ultimate fail-safe, which is that if there's still if it's still contested at the, you know, the drop-dead date when they have to send electors to the, you know, I think it's December 8th is the date. If it's still being contested and the courts are still, you know, hashing this out, and they have to send electors, they've got electors in some states. Pennsylvania was mentioned specifically in the Gellman piece as being a place where Republicans are willing, they're considering the idea that if they believe that the mail-in votes or whatever the margin that Biden might have is fraudulent, they have a constitutional ability then to basically go against whatever the popular vote is and send their electors to the Congress. Now, there's an idea that there could be competing electors. There could be, you know, there's all kinds of things like that. But this is the kind of crazy talk that we're dealing with. And when you ask Trump, Do you agree that there should be a peaceful transfer of power? And he says no. He says I don't know. You know, I have to wait and see, or whatever. What he said on Wednesday, and then says this thing about, you know, if they count the ballots. The ballots are a mess. They're a disgrace. The Democrats know it. If they count the ballots, there won't be a peaceful transfer of power. But it won't happen. There'll be a continuity. And what he meant by that was that if they count the ballots, I won't win. So we can't let them count the ballots. I mean, that's basically what he's saying. And he's saying it up, and even through some of the Republicans, you know, you could tell they were kind of going, whoa, getting really, you know, why is he saying that out loud? Because I know they're fine with it. They're obviously fine with the plan. It's just that they don't think that it's wise to be telegraphing what you're doing. And so this is crazy, you know. I mean, Sam, you and I have been talking for months about how, hey, you know, it's going to get crazy this fall.
Yeah.
It's gonna, everybody get ready. It's going to get weird. Well, here we are. And, you know, all I think at this point anybody can do is do exactly what you were saying. You know, do the vote like your life depends on it, in a way, in the best way you can, to make sure that your vote gets counted, and you know, get prepared for what is going to be a very likely to be an extremely contentious post-election period, and we don't really know how it's going to come out. And I think, you know, we're going to have to be prepared for, taking it to the streets. I mean, what else do you have in that situation?
Well, this week on the Majority Report, I talked to Susan Mettler, who has written a book that basically covers four threats to democracy. And she and her co-author argued that we have had many times in the history of this country where we've had three of these elements working simultaneously. One time in the 1850s, which, as we know, ended up leading to a civil war. She said this is the first time that they reckon that we have been facing four of these elements. And there is a quality of we are at an inflection point that you see things. I mean, we were talking beforehand. Alex Azar made what was called a power grab at the FDA this week, where he basically took over the process in which you would essentially determine whether a vaccine is safe or not, among other things. Maybe that's just a coincidence that they decided to do it in September, 20th, before the election. But that is indicative of the degradation of all of our agencies, and not just the degradation in terms of Bush-style degradation, which was horrific in and of itself. The structure is falling apart of these things.
Yep.
And it has become, sort of a more and more naked kleptocracy in many respects. And there's always been an element of this in our government, broadly speaking. And certainly during the Bush years, we would talk about these things, but this is just at another level. And, I find it very hard to believe that Bill Barr's federal police officers secret police that he has basically amassed are going to be sitting at home on November 3rd, just, hanging out. The idea that they're not going to be deploying these folks so when we talk about getting onto the streets, I don't think we're going to see the type of, violence and suppression that we see in maybe other countries, but we'll see some of it. And, the question is, will it be necessary? Will people, and there's just not the tradition in this country for people to come out and march. Well, I guess it hasn't been that way for 50 years, 60 years, right? I mean, the civil rights movement was the last time that we saw mass protests and extended protests that were about democracy. And, I hope that we have that in us, because it's very possible we will need that.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't know if we have that in us. In fact, when I say it out loud, I'm kind of thinking, well, I mean, really?
No, we don't.
Are we
right.
Really going to do this? I mean, I don't even know. I'm sure some people will obviously.
Yep.
They'll come
of
out
course,
and say
of course.
Protest.
And we're seeing that with the BLM protests and that have been going on around the country. But when you're talking about something like this, when you're talking about this type of democracy, you need to have a wide array of people coming out, people who have never come out before, come out and do so in a way that will require a significant amount of bravery, I think. And let me just put a little caveat in here, because I've seen some trolls, frankly, on the right and the left, who think that this type of talk is overreacting. you don't get a second chance to react to this. That's, I guess that's, you know, one of the things that I am sensing, that we are headed down a river, and one turn on this river is just the river. The other turn of the river is a waterfall, a very, very steep waterfall. We don't get to do a do-over if we go over that waterfall. Right. We are in a different place. We are never going to get back to that other place. That just doesn't work that way. And so there certainly hasn't been a time like this in my lifetime. And there's, I think, little doubt that if we have a situation where Donald Trump, I mean, look, it's going to be horrible if Donald Trump gets a majority of the votes on that day. I mean, make no mistake about it. It's going to be horrible. But if we have a situation where Donald Trump doesn't, and there are members of the Republican Party in different states around the country, and there are members of the Republican Party or the conservative movement in institutions such as state and federal courts who participate in helping Donald Trump win despite the fact that all the votes are not counted, they've all sealed their fate too, right? Like they, I mean, there's a reason why a guy like Donald Trump tries to bring as many people in as he can, because if they're all guilty of something, right, they don't turn on him. And, right, and because their determination is like, this is my fate, I might as well go forward with it. And that's, you know, that's why that scenario is so disturbing, because it is, you've got a lot of people in a positions of power who are basically saying it's go time and we don't come back from that. And so, you know, I think if there's ever been a time in my life to be alarmist, this is it.
I agree. And I found that just, you know, from all sides where I was hearing this over the last couple of days, of people going, oh, come on. You know, well, for one thing, I remember hearing that from an awful lot of very, very important pundits telling me that there's no way Donald Trump could become president. So, you know, I've learned my lesson that, you know, the great sages who make these predictions don't know what they're talking about. But more importantly, look, we have 4 years. We've watched him. And just in the last week, here's just a short list of the things that he has said. He has said that he's praised violence against journalists over and over again in his rallies. And I mean praised it, said it's a beautiful sight, talking about some reporter being slammed and tossed aside like a bag of popcorn, he said. And his people cheered and cheered and laughed and thought that was terrific. That's fascist talk. I'm sorry, I don't, you know, excusing it and saying, oh, that's just Donald Trump. There were no Republicans standing up. Nobody of his followers walked out. Those people are fine with it. They are fine with violence against journalists. That is the stuff that you have in banana republics, in repressive autocracies around the world. This is not normal. His campaign is calling for able-bodied election squads, which means he's asking people to go out to polling places and intimidate others. And because of the, what's it called? I can't remember what it is, but they just reversed a ruling by the what the heck's it called? I am sorry, I'm getting old.
That's
here.
Okay.
I can't remember the word. In any case, but what they did was reverse a ruling that didn't allow people to do this kind of intimidation. And in places like Michigan, they've got operatives there going, "Hey, you know, it's free, we're good to go." And you know, we have the fact that they overruled the Voting Rights Act in the last couple of years. So that sets the table. This week, you know, they have dismissed that the fact, and this is coming out all over the place, and even the CIA and various others, that the Russians are absolutely attacking this election. They are involved. They're pushing it. And one of the most astonishing parts of it is that they don't really have to do much work because they're basically just amplifying what Donald Trump is saying. Yeah, you know, I mean, they're not even having to make stuff up like they did in 2016. Their campaign, Trump campaign is pushing manipulated Biden videos all over the internet, they're pushing this stuff out. This stuff where Biden is supposedly looking at a teleprompter and in an interview, but it wasn't. He was looking at a screen. Somebody was talking to him from a screen, you know, like we have Zoom calls or whatever. He's claiming he can override the FDA on the timing of the vaccine, which we just talked about. He claims that he gets a grade A response on the pandemic on the day that we crossed the 200,000 dead mark. And he says that, you know, if it weren't for me, we'd have millions dead. Well, this is absurd. You look around the country, there's nobody that has 2 million dead, and we wouldn't have either. I mean, he's contradicting the CDC on masks. He's got this quack, Scott Atlas, who is a radiologist, who is a Fox News doctor, in there talking about herd immunity. And, you know, he won't guarantee a peaceful transition. That's just in 1 week. I mean, if you're not going to react to that, or I should say overreact to that, you're nuts. This is not normal, and it's not even normal for Donald Trump. I mean, even for the craziness that he has done, it's not normal for him. And this is all among a backdrop where we had, you know, we just learned that they are doing forced hysterectomies on immigrant women at the border. You know, we can't use the fascist word, but I mean, I'm sorry. There's a history of that kind of stuff going on,
well,
too.
Yeah. I mean, this is
really bad.
Yeah. And to me, what is really indicative of this is the nakedness in which you have these Republican politicians in the Senate who will, I mean, Lindsey Graham, I hold in the lowest esteem that you could hold someone in. But he literally said, use this tape that I'm now making, this videotape that I'm now making, if I was ever to allow a Supreme Court justice to be nominated in an election year, and it can be in Donald Trump's fourth year, I don't care. Use this tape. Use my words against me. I mean, that's pretty naked to do a 180 on that. And I can't reiterate enough, and I know that I don't need to tell you this, but I can't reiterate enough. The Republican Party will follow him into an open volcano. They will do this, and that's all you need. You don't need much more. I mean, you have to believe that Donald Trump has some type of like, hey, this is too far. I really want to be president and I don't want to go to jail, but this is too far. He's not going to stop. And, you know, the trick here, of course, is like, how do you creep along until you get to the point where, it's like a boiling frog on some level, I guess, too. I hate to keep using metaphors for these, but how do you creep along so that you don't set off so much alarm bells that, the Republicans around him basically say, hey, whoa. And those alarm bells are obviously like they're second order. The politicians are second order. It's that you upset enough of people out there, you know, maybe wealthy people or whomever it is that go to the politicians and say like, hey, wait a second, this is too much. You got to stop him. That is their challenge is we need to do that until we're in a position where we have enough power that you'd need a much more bolder response from these Republican politicians to stop them. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what it comes down to. That's what. And again, if in 6 weeks, the Joe Biden wins the election, there's no attempts to change the results of the election based upon, how people voted and whatnot. And we'll get on this microphone together, Heather, and we'll just go egg on our face. Egg on our face. Boy, boy, oh boy.
I hope so.
Folks
I'll
got a real kick.
I'll be rubbing it in. I'm fine with that.
I hope folks got a real kick on how nervous we were about this. Nice to have that experience every now and then.
Yeah.
But I think that is incredibly naive to assume that these things aren't, that we're not going to see, things like this. And I think I just know it from every, you know, sort of like experience I have in the way that progress or, you know, and really just time, right, moves forward. There are events that spike, and that takes you to a new normal. When we do this show, you get growth that goes, you know, 5, 7, 8%. It goes along, and then all of a sudden it spikes. And it resets at a different, higher level yep. than it was before, a dramatic jump. And that, I think, is the way that history works. Things build, they build, they build, and then they snap. And they reset in a different way. And I'm afraid we're at a moment like this. And let me make no mistake. If we get to the other side of this, with Joe Biden as president, we're still on a trajectory. I mean, the things need to be addressed in this country, severe things. It's just that we bought ourselves a little bit of time. I don't think that, you know, the day after Joe Biden is inaugurated is, you know, we can take a deep breath. Absolutely not. That just gives us a position, puts us in a position to do the urgent work we need to, right? Like, this is like we're facing the prospect of trying to do triage on our body politic in a burning building. And the triage doesn't go away if we can manage to keep the building from, you know, being on fire. And we still have the triage, and that's a pretty, you know, important thing to do. Just getting
more
to,
than ever, go, I think.
Well,
I mean, I think it's more than ever, because what this has shown, look, the Republicans learned something. They've been, you know, leading up to this for many, many years. But they've learned how far they can go. They've learned that there really isn't a lot of there aren't a lot of limits on them if they are completely shameless. If
yes.
they do not care that everybody's screaming and yelling and going, "Oh my God, you're destroying democracy." They've learned that if they don't care about that, if they don't bother with that, I mean, look at Bill Barr. He's a perfect example. This guy knows that he can push it and push it and push it. They've exposed all the fault lines in our system. There are huge fault lines in our system that have to do with us assuming over the course of centuries that it depended on the character of the people that were elected, that somehow or another, that, you know, we would live by these rules and norms. Well, you know, that's not going to work anymore, because the Republicans, the conservatives in this country, have learned that shamelessness works for them to maintain power. And what this means is that it's just what you're saying, but this is not going to be over. If Biden wins or manages to somehow do this in a way, even if he wins on election night, and there's, you know, and Trump says count all the votes, and then we count them all, and they're, you know, and he Biden still wins, and yay, you know, the system worked. Even if all that happens, and I agree with you, I think that's really a long shot at this point. Everything that's come before, everything that Trump has done, everything the Republicans have done for the last 30 years, including the war in Iraq, including the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the stolen election in 2000. I mean, this goes all the way back. That all of this stuff has got to lead the Democrats, and I think the progressives are going to have to lead the way on here, is that we have a crisis in our democracy. It is huge. It is overwhelming. It has been completely exposed as being inadequate to dealing with people who have a will to power, like these Republicans do. And, you know, they can slink off into their little corner. Maybe, oh, well, you know, they've got their tails between their legs. Don't believe it. They've been indoctrinated into this belief now, and the Democrats have got to expend huge amounts of political capital, energy, whatever you want to call it, on fixing the democracy. And that means that they have to use every constitutional means, by which I mean putting more members on the Supreme Court, adding states, doing those kind of things, because this is way out of balance. These
yep.
people are willing to rule by fiat from a minority. We can't let them do that. That's they'll just, you know, we're on the verge of destruction. I know it sounds, now here I am being overheated and, you know, hysterical about this, but I don't care, because to me this really is I'm not going to let anybody tell me that I'm not seeing what I'm seeing. And I am seeing this. I mean, we've got 200,000 people dead because of, you know, we elected somebody who's incompetent and have a party behind him that allows him to do anything he wants, including failing to deal with the greatest public health crisis in American history. And, you know, we can't just sit back and go, well, you know, the institutions are holding, you know, everything's going to be fine. Just let's just get through this, guys, and then we'll go back. And we want to keep that filibuster. And maybe we'll have blue slips, too, because those were so great. You know, all this kind of crap that you hear from some of the old guard, that has to go. You know, that has to go. I mean, there has to be a – if this didn't wake up the Democrats, nothing will. And, by the way, if they don't wake up to this, they're going to have a revolution within the Democratic Party, because I know that the younger folks and the progressives see what's going on.
I think that's going to – I mean, I think that's going to happen anyways, frankly. And, I mean, maybe that's wishful thinking on my part, but I think that's going to happen anyways. And, I mean, you know, one of the things that scares me – is we've seen data now where we have young African-American voters are rather unenthused about Joe Biden. It doesn't necessarily mean that they won't vote, that they won't come out and vote. We'll see. But I mean, I'm not the most enthused about Joe Biden, but I'm going to vote and get everyone I can to vote. And I'm going to vote for a Democrat in my blue state for president, probably for the first time. I think I probably voted for Barack Obama in 08. I'm quite sure. But that is the only time I have since Dukakis, I think it was. And so, and I'm not even sure if I got to vote. I think I did vote for Dukakis. I tend to think like, okay, I'm just going to help out a different party or whatnot. And in this instance, I literally think that there could be a material difference between Joe Biden getting 10 million votes versus 3 million votes. And it doesn't matter where he gets them, because if this ends up in the courts, it could influence a judge's thinking. If this ends up in the streets, it will create a lot more righteous anger that Joe Biden got 10 million more votes than the guy who is president. But I'm concerned. I am concerned. But like you said at the top of the show, Joe Biden is running the campaign he wanted to run. You saw it even in the context of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the idea of court packing. It makes total sense to me that Joe Biden, based upon the campaign he's running, he would say, I'm not going to talk about court packing. I'm not going to get into that, because he wants to make sure that this campaign is all about Donald Trump. And I have always been a little skeptical I think this can be a referendum about Donald Trump, but you cannot control outside forces, right? And something like a Supreme Court justice dying, that's something you cannot control. And the problem with making this just a referendum on Donald Trump is it gives you, as a campaign, and again, I want to reiterate, I don't think Joe Biden at this point can do anything else than he's doing. And I think he's doing what he was set out to do. He's doing it, right? I don't think Joe Biden is going to become an aggressive candidate with an aggressive platform that he can introduce people and excite people with about. I think that ship has sailed. I don't think that Joe Biden was ever that person. And, you know, he is running the campaign that a Joe Biden should run. But the danger is when you have a campaign like this, when it's a referendum about Trump, you as a candidate don't really have a chance or an opportunity to do anything other than lay low. And sometimes the things change in the context that require you to not lay low. And if your campaign is built around the idea of laying low, then you can't do that. And knock on wood, I hope it works, but it may not. And there's really... I mean, do you get what I'm saying here? It's like,
sure, I do.
When you have a passive candidate, you're just dropping a marble down a prosciutto, one of those prosciutto games, and you don't really get to control where it falls. You're just hoping that, you know, that gravity does its job, but sometimes, you know, somebody comes over and says, like, I'm going to tilt the board a little bit like this. And in some ways, maybe Ginsburg's death is that tilt. Maybe, the mail-in ballots are that tilt. You know, we don't know. And we can, in many respects, only hope and go out and vote again. If you can vote early, vote early. If you can be a poll watcher, if you're someone who has a little reason to be concerned about COVID and you feel confident about going into these situations, you know, polling places are going to be safer than we would imagine and safer than, you know, going to the supermarket or something like that. But if you can go in there and you can be a poll watcher, and be prepared, courage, in these instances, go do it. People looking for a civic thing to do, go do it. And you're doing it not, if it's easier for you to think like I'm not doing that for Joe Biden, but it's easier for you to think about it, you're doing it for the other people who want to vote, or maybe candidates that you do like, do it for that. Find a way to motivate yourself to do these things, because it is, it genuinely is, possibly one of the last opportunities that you could have to do it.
This is an existential election. Yeah. It really is. If Donald Trump somehow manages to get it 4 more years, we can't even really contemplate what that means. But particularly if he gets it in this way, that means that our democracy is pretty much dead. We've now turned in, we're Belarus, basically. We've turned into that. And just think about that. We're the most powerful nation on earth. We have a military that's bigger than all militaries in the world combined. The whole world practically is pegged to our currency. Just imagine what's going to happen if he wins again, and especially if he wins by these extra constitutional, sort of quasi-constitutional means that are just completely beyond the pale. By disqualifying votes and sending electors or any of these other shenanigans, winning with a Supreme Court majority that he just put on the court for that purpose. If he wins that way, everything's going to be going to fall apart. I have no belief that the economy, you want to see a market crash? Of course it'll crash, because this will mean that the United States of America, the most powerful nation on earth, has just gone full banana republic.
Yep.
And, you want to see the rest of the world suddenly reorganize itself really fast when it comes to, military alliances and things like that? You just watch, because we'll be the most dangerous country in the history of the world at that point, because we will no longer be reliable, stable in any way. I mean, we'll be in the midst of some kind of revolution.
Yep.
And we're not playing games. I mean, this, I know it's fashionable to say, oh, come on now. Well, no, look at what we're dealing with here. So, this is a really, really important thing, and it's really important that everybody takes it seriously and gets out there and does what they can. We have one last chance.
Heather, we will touch base next week. I guess we could take our temperature.
It'll be after the debate. The first debate, I think, is
that's right. The first debate is in just a couple of days on Tuesday night. And so maybe that will calm us in some way. But I'm not sure. I mean, frankly, I'm not sure there's much that can happen between now and, I don't know, December 1st. That, I don't know what day it's going to be, sometime in November, maybe in December, maybe in early January, where we go, phew. But I don't know that, I don't think that there is going to be a moment between now and November 3rd where I'm going to feel any more confident than I do now, which is, I'm not that confident. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just think that there's nothing that can happen that can really, give us an indication of what's going to happen. Let's put it that way. And so,
I think you're right.
Folks got to get out
cross
there.
Cross your fingers, yeah. And,
well,
and do what you can do.
Cross your fingers and do what you can do is really the important part. Do what you can do, folks. Heather, as always, a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
How did the aerospace company TransDigm record record profits during a pandemic while laying off employees, while regular Americans were left out in the cold? Next guest has co-written a piece for ProPublica that explains how billions of dollars were transferred to corporations through the CARES Act. Joining us now to discuss his piece, The Big Corporate Rescue and the America That's Too Small to Save, Justin Elliott.
So, Justin, you wrote with a couple other writers over at ProPublica, The Big Corporate Rescue and the America That's Too Small to Save. You decided as a team, you decided to basically look at Cleveland as a microcosm in some respects of America and how, to the extent that we have had COVID relief, and there has been certainly a lot of money that has been thrown towards it, COVID relief in terms of economic relief. You looked at Cleveland in many respects, as a microcosm for the country. Why Cleveland?
Yeah, so we were trying to get our heads around what has happened with the federal response in the last 6 months. And one of the confusing things is there's been this kind of alphabet soup of programs and by Congress, and then the Federal Reserve has also done a lot. And it's just sort of hard to understand unless you look at one place. So we decided to look at Cleveland partly because there's an interesting large Fortune 500 company there called TransDigm, which is an aerospace manufacturer that is representative in many ways of how large corporations have been helped in the last 6 months. And it's also a typical American city in many other ways. It had sort of a average level of COVID cases and that sort of thing. So it was a good city as a case study.
And we should be clear here. You're looking at this, you know, strictly in terms of what the implications were of the different programs. And let me just add a little editorial that we will more than likely not see any more aid until at least after the election. And then who knows? It really is in many respects a function of the results. There is the Democrats are holding out for a sort of pared down version of their bill that they passed in the House called the HEROES Act. And Nancy Pelosi had said with much fanfare back in April, after they passed the second round of the PPP, which is the Paycheck Protection Act, we're going to talk about that, PPA, I should say, that they would get around to helping municipalities and states. That's going to happen, and it appears like it won't happen, although she is getting now pressure, from what I've been reading, from so-called frontline Democrats in the House to make any type of deal because people are starting to hurt. And so let's go back. Give us a rundown of, and then we'll go through the specific ones that in what you found there, but give us a rundown, just broadly speaking, of what kind of relief was involved in the CARES Act and the PPA and the sort of subsequent interim PPA and any other a bill that has passed since then. I think those are that's it, that help Americans and American businesses.
Sure. So, I mean, the big picture finding here, and this is true both of Cleveland and I think most of the country, is that large corporations not only went into this whole crisis, with more money and better able to kind of survive it, but they received kind of the most rapid assistance from the federal government with the least strings attached, and small business and sort of ordinary people have gotten some help, but I think are going to, you know, we're seeing small business be sort of crushed right now. And I think the country's not going to be recognizable when we come out of this. But to answer your question, there's a bunch of different buckets of money. So one of the big buckets, of course, was the is the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program. And this was money that went or was supposed to go to small business and supposed to be spent largely on keeping workers employed, whether or not the business was doing well. Then, of course, there was a large bucket of federal unemployment money. That's the extra $600 that, as you noted, has since run out and we all thought was going to be renewed. But Congress doesn't seem to be doing anything, and people are, you know, a lot of people are really in trouble now because of that. Then, of course, there was the stimulus checks. So a lot of people got the $1,200 and up checks in the mail. And then there was a few kind of random buckets of money, like the airline industry got a special bucket, hospitals got a special bucket, and so on. So that sort of covered most of what Congress did. But then there's this whole other sort of category of aid, and that's what the Federal Reserve did. And so there's a whole...
And let me just stop you there for 1 second,
yeah,
Justin.
Sure.
When we talk about that, the money that the Federal Reserve, we should also say, though, that if I'm not mistaken, the CARES Act authorized the Treasury to sort of backstop that, or the Fed. I mean, the Fed was obviously it's an independent institution, but that was contemplated in the CARES Act, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't
Absolutely.
Just okay.
Absolutely.
I just want to be clear.
It's a very good point. It's actually often lost because, as you say, the Fed operates with some level of independence, and the Fed did do some things on its own, but the major programs the Fed created were authorized in the CARES Act. There was some money provided in a kind of complicated and confusing way, and I think also importantly. The Fed programs, all the major Fed programs, were actually created with the Trump administration. They were created with the approval of Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, which is a fact that often gets lost. So the most significant things the Fed did were not just the Fed. It was also the Trump administration.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, and I might be mistaken about this, it was almost as if the Treasury, what Congress did was authorize and appropriate money to function as sort of almost like a percentage of capital reserves that a bank would have. So, you know, banks are allowed by regulators to maintain, let's say, 7% capital reserves, you know, actual cash, and then they can loan out the rest. And it's almost as if the Treasury functioned in that way for the Fed. Everybody does it with a wink and a nod because I think these folks all realize, like, we can just print money. But this is done as a way of authorizing it. So I just want to be clear because this is statutory on some level, and this is our lawmakers are reacting to this. Theoretically, if the CARES Act doesn't pass, the Fed, they may have found some other mechanism to do this. But it's a novel mechanism, and I think the Fed felt like they needed authorization from the politicians, essentially, to do it, and that's why it happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and there's still debate about whether this was necessary and why it happened by people who watched the Fed. But you're right, there was money actually appropriated in the CARES Act, and then. Sort of doled out by the Trump administration, by the Treasury to the Fed, where they essentially said, we, the Treasury, are going to take the first losses to the extent there's losses on these huge loan programs the Fed created. And it was kind of like a form of leverage, like the Treasury was giving the Fed $10 billion and the Fed would turn that into $100 billion.
Yep.
For these, you know, and there's several examples of that.
Okay. And so, and that's important to establish because this is public policy that we're doing here. This is not like, you know, the Fed is not going off rogue. This is contemplated. Everybody signed on to this. And the, you know, and we'll get into the specifics now of what you found in Cleveland. But the broad story is, and this is, and many people were saying this at the time, and myself included, but there were others, that the dynamic is what the problem is. It's not so much that I think people had a problem with helping corporate America, but it's as if there was the biggest players, the best suited to weather this this storm, as it were given a green light, a green flag, you know, going around the racetrack, and everybody else was given a yellow flag. And so what we've created ultimately, and I think you're going to tell us this in terms of what you found in Cleveland, is a dynamic where we have concentrated wealth and power even more than we had prior to this, which was already highly problematic. But tell us about TransDigm and how this played out in Cleveland.
Sure. So TransDigm is a good example of, it's a large company. It's in the Fortune 500. No one's ever heard of it. It sort of has this amusing generic corporate name that would be out of a movie or something like that. But it would basically, they own dozens of aerospace manufacturers around the country, many of which have kind of mini monopolies. Like, they own a company that makes the seatbelts for planes, and there's only like one company that makes seatbelts for planes, it turns out. And so it's highly profitable. But they also, you know, prior to the pandemic, are a company that has operated with a lot of debt. So they sort of have an aggressive, almost kind of private equity like structure, which has been extremely profitable for the executives and the shareholders. So just to give you an example, the chairman, a guy named Nicholas Howley, who lives in a sort of posh suburb outside of Cleveland, you know, made like $60 million in 1 year. So it's probably, I don't know if he's a billionaire, but if he's not, he's close to a billionaire, even though, you know, he runs this company that no one's ever heard of. So, you know, aerospace, of course, planes, everything to do with aviation was one of the things that has been crushed by the pandemic. It's kind of like restaurants, right? So you might expect that a company like TransDigm would be in big trouble. And so if you rewind back to March, when you know, it began to dawn on everyone that this thing was real and everything was going to change, before the CARES Act even passed, one of the first kind of dramatic things that happened in the economy was the bond market seized up. So companies like TransDigm rely on debt, right? They regularly borrow large amounts of money to finance their operations, to pay their executives, to pay dividends to their shareholders. And suddenly in mid-March, the investors usually put up the money for these bonds, got terrified of the pandemic, and it became impossible to borrow money. And so that's when the Fed first intervened very quickly, even before the CARES Act. And Jay Powell, the Fed chairman, came out and announced that the Fed was going to buy, for the first time ever, corporate bonds. So the Fed was essentially going to enter this market and buy corporate debt. And this was very effective. So what happened is,
and can we just pause here for one second, Justin?
Sure.
Because this is, you know, reminiscent on some level of, you know, what we went through with the financial crisis on some level. There are loans that are out there. They're being essentially called because the way that these people revolve their credit. And the Fed steps in and backstops it. Now, just as a complete side note, I should say here, just to be a little bit of a gadfly, you know, people talk about how Social Security, for instance, is some type of Ponzi scheme. I mean, arguably speaking, right? When you're just revolving credit constantly. And if the idea that somebody says we're going to stop lending you money, that you can't deal with it, that to me sounds a little bit Ponzi scheme-ish. It's just that in this instance, essentially, Fed came in as if they were God and said, don't worry, we got you covered. You're never going to run out of people who are going to feed this, because we're going to feed it right now. I mean, that's essentially what we looked at in that moment as they come in as an emergency, and then continue with the story, because then Congress basically comes in and says, okay, now we're going to really authorize this.
Yeah, sure. So basically what happens is, and if you look at like a chart of a bond market index, you can see it's going along flat and steady. And then in March, it starts plummeting and especially the junk bond market. And this is debt for kind of riskier companies, which, by the way, it happens to include TransDigm. Then the Fed steps in, creates these bond buying programs, essentially tells the market, people sometimes call this the Fed put. It's like basically, as you said, it's kind of like insurance. It's like we as the central bank are not going to let this market fall below a certain point. So of course, when investors hear that, they are much more comfortable buying bonds again and lending money because the central bank has said, don't worry, we're not going to let it fall below a certain point. So how that plays out for a company like TransDigm is in early April, after this Fed intervention, they go to the bond markets and they borrow $1.5 billion, just this one company. And this was part of a larger debt boom, borrowing boom created by these Fed actions. And they tell their investors, look, there's uncertain times ahead. You know, we were in the aviation business, and we want this money basically for two reasons. One, as a backup fund in case things really get bad, and two, we might want to go on an acquisition spree and buy more small companies to get even bigger. And so the striking thing about this is, that this was only early April. And, this is a few weeks after everyone realized how bad this was going to be. And already you have companies like TransDigm, many other companies in similar situations, able to access billions of dollars in aid directly because of these public policy decisions by the federal government. The CARES Act passed, I believe, at the end of March. That included the Paycheck Protection and the unemployment. But, as many people know, those programs took weeks and even months to get underway, to start getting money out the door. You had people, on the phone with their unemployment offices for months before they were able to get the money that was due to them. And so this is sort of the first important moment in this kind of divergence between the relief that was provided at scale and quickly to big business, while small business and ordinary working people were, either still waiting or getting kind of scrapped.
And we should say there's two aspects of this that bears sort of like a noting. One is, on one hand, that is the speed in which it arrived. Was a function of not so much the legislation, although arguably, I guess, had Congress had a little more foresight, they could have authorized, the Fed or the IRS to distribute this money. But there was a mechanism already for the Fed to provide this relief to corporations. We do not have. We don't like have the pipes essentially to provide this aid to small business we do have it in terms of unemployment, and but the pipes are rusty in terms of unemployment. The stimulus was also, the pipes were rusty essentially in terms of getting it out there. And so that's like a pre-existing problem that I'm not sure how much you'd need lawmakers with more foresight, as opposed to just a lack of interest in saving corporate America. But the second part of this is, corporate America was not going to feel this until it had already been the pain had already been absorbed by the individuals, right? I mean, corporate America is downstream from unemployed people and small business on some level in terms of feeling the effects of this, because they're bigger and because the consumers need to feel like the pinch before they stop buying stuff from the corporations. And then the idea that by April, these corporations were turning this into a buying opportunity suggests that something's very out of whack. Like, right, like you have, I'm trying to think of the metaphor, but it's essentially like, you know, you're unleashing these tigers, essentially into this nature preserve that you're trying to save. And they're just going around and they're just eating everybody.
Right. I mean, it's, as you say, I mean, we entered this with, after, you know, decades of sort of, gutting of the administrative state that would allow for, you know, an actually functional unemployment system and, a way to even the stimulus check, something that seems like it would be relatively straightforward, literally just sending most of the population money. Still to this day, there's several million people that haven't gotten their money because basically record keeping issues. We have the Fed, which is the, you know, not only the sort of least democratically accountable institution, but you know, arguably, this is where the sort of skilled technocrats live. They are the rescue system for large corporations. And then the rest of the economy has to deal with, you know, whatever a sort of dysfunctional Congress serves up. And even if Congress wanted to get more money out, there's sort of pre-existing problems that make it difficult to do. And, you know, the Fed people will say, I mean, not the current Fed people, but there was the former Fed people will just tell you frankly that these moves by the Fed will increase inequality, and that's just the cost in their argument of having a faster recovery. So you know, when the Fed starts these huge bond buying programs, you know, we've seen this, that's going to lead the stock market to get more expensive. And so if you're a wealthy person who owns stock, you're going to get richer because of what the Fed did. And the Fed will defend this. And, you know, there's an argument to be had there. But when you pair that, when you pair these Fed actions, which lead, you know, they will tell you to wealth inequality, with a kind of anemic response by Congress in terms of aid for small business and ordinary working people, you know, it's going to aggravate the situation even more. And I think, you know, we're still in the middle of this, of course, but I think, you know, given the sort of lack of action we're seeing right now by Congress, I think you're going to, it's a solid prediction that we're going to see these trends sort of become even more magnified as more and more small businesses go out of business, as unemployment drags on, and these big businesses like TransDigm are sitting on, you know, cash piles of billions of dollars and are going to start going on acquisition sprees.
And of course, you know, and then we're going to have problems with cities and states starting to lay off people too, coming into the fall. I mean, I think we're about to see this, you know, the economic disparity and suffering, frankly, crest soon, or you know, hopefully crest. But there's another issue here that seems to, I have two more sort of like things that I want to talk about the politics, because obviously there has been, and let me just say this with the understanding that my criticism should be understood of the Republicans. They don't care at all about this, but ostensibly, in terms of a strategic mistake that the Democrats made, they, in basically signing off on both the second PPP round and the first sort of Fed bond buying, corporate bond buying round, they gave the Republicans everything they could possibly want, and there was no incentive for the Republicans to come back. And I think this was fairly obvious to anybody who's been watching what Republicans care about for, I don't know, decades. But let me ask you this. Don't we have a problem at one point? Because if the actual, if the economy, you know, as people sometimes, define as Main Street, but if we, if the economy in terms of like people getting, long-term unemployed, we're going to have mass evictions happen, you know, depending on which state you're in over the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 months. We're going to have cutbacks on city and state local services and jobs. At one point, the loans, these corporations are going to spend the money, right? They're going to spend the money they got on these free loans. They may buy other entities and get bigger. They may just, you know, obviously write themselves a little bonuses. We've been very smart executives. We got money for free and we turned that into, money. And we deserve some bonuses. But at one point, the merry-go-round stops, or the music stops, and everybody's looking for a chair. Isn't the Fed now going to have to just keep providing loans? You know, like they have to now revolve this credit for this corporate credit?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think, it's an open question, whether, we're seeing an asset bubble being inflated right now that at some point is going to pop, whether that's in 3 years or 5 years or 20 years, who knows? I mean, I think it's really uncharted territory. Literally the Fed intervening directly into corporate bond markets is unprecedented. It's never been done before in the history of the institution. What we've seen so far is that there's enough private investor money out there with this sort of Fed insurance guarantee in the background to keep lending to companies like Transam. And also, I think you just made a very important point, which is this money, by definition, has no strings attached. So people may remember from 3 or 4 months ago, all these PPP loans that were going to small businesses, there was these incredibly elaborate rules. They kept changing the rules. It was like you had to spend 60% on payroll and 40% on other things.
Had to be done within 10 weeks of the money being released to you?
Right, exactly. There was this incredibly elaborate and sort of constantly shifting rules. This Fed intervention that led to this debt boom doesn't come with any of those strings attached. So going back to the example of TransDime, even though they're sitting on a cash pile of literally billions of dollars, they actually announced also in April that they were laying off 3,000 people. And then in the same press release, they said, we're cutting our executive compensation, our task compensation by 50%. But then when you look into what that really means, it turns out these guys get paid mostly in stock. So cutting the task compensation by 50% might be like a 3 or 4% total haircut. You see the shareholders, the executives, the bondholders enriched by this, even while a company like TransDime that has all this money is laying off thousands of people around the country. So it really is like a two-tiered system. And I think to your question of what's going to happen in the future, I mean, is there going to be a moment when sort of the music stops for these large companies? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's unknowable, but it certainly will be interesting to see.
Well, it is. It's a really interesting piece, and it really provides a good example of what was problematic with this CARES Act and what will be problematic with this CARES Act. The big corporate rescue and the America that's too small to save. Justin Elliott, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Justin Elliott has been a reporter with ProPublica since 2012, where he has covered money and influence in the Obama and Trump administrations, the American Red Cross, and TurboTax maker Intuit. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all our free podcast subscribers that converted into supporters to help support the show. I can't thank you enough. If you're listening to the free version of the program, consider becoming a supporter. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringfireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
It's in my blood, it's in my water. You tried to tame me from the start. In that deadness in your eye, flash your flesh, desperate for it.